first and, alas, last date with Cheryl Miller, only to find the group composed of people whom his father would describe as kooks. It seemed as if everybody in the group had been kidnapped at least once by aliens, and several seemed to have round-trip tickets to the solar system. Even if they were sincere, he found their tales, when matched against his skepticism, impossible to believe. But over the course of these months, he was becoming something of an alien himself. Unemployment does not do a whole lot for a person's self-esteem, and the routine of filling out job applications gets not only demeaning but exhausting. In his nightly prayers, he'd never lost the habit of praying, even if he didn't believe in the deity exactly as he, she, it was portrayed by organized religion. He asked for a job, a girlfriend, long good health for his parents, and some sort of sign that his sudden interest in the occult wasn't just some aberration brought on by the stress of not being able to find a job. A few weeks later, at least one of his prayers was answered. In a branch library he'd never visited before, he found a thick, hardback book called The Demonologist. More than he could have ever imagined, the book he held would change Donald Bennett's life in the most profound way. Peculiar Bites. After his own startling experience in the bedroom, Ed found that the team had had one of its own. Brady Cotter, who had been carrying a video pack on his back, had felt his shoulders being jerked first one way and then another by a force he could neither see nor explain. Brady also had the sensation that electricity was filling the air in the room. The hair on his arms stood straight up. Chris McKenna, already an expert on demonology, knew exactly what was going on. "One of the spirits is drawing its energy from you. You're like a power plant for it." Lorraine, who had come into the room, began praying for Brady, and very soon the sensation of electricity surging through his body left him. They were most peculiar bite marks. They had been inflicted on Jack Smurl a few days earlier while he was in the shower. At first he wondered if a wasp might not have gotten into the bathroom. Then he remembered the month, wasps in February. The next bite was so severe that Jack had cried out in pain. Now Chris McKenna was snapping photographs of a bite on Jack's ear. "When he came down from the bathroom," Janet explained, "his whole left ear was red." Ed Warren, watching as Chris snapped photographs for later evidence, said, "How many bite marks are there?"
"Three," Janet said.
"It's mocking the Trinity," Ed said. "Three of a kind is always symbolic of the mockery."
"Will it go away?"
Janet said, still concerned that the bite might become a serious infection. "I'm pretty sure it will," Ed said, "if we just keep on praying." A few days later, the bite had gone away entirely, but that was one of the few pieces of good news the Smurls had that week. Simon, their beloved dog, was levitated and in the process became so frightened that Janet and Jack wondered if a dog could be driven insane. And Mary Smurl once again saw the strange, dark, transparent form in her bedroom, standing in the doorway as if summoning her to some terrible fate. Lorraine Warren. "When our grandson, Chris McKenna, returned from an early spring visit to the Smurls, he, Ed, and I sat down for an in-depth assessment of the situation at the house, from the demonic rapping that plagued their nights to the psychological effects the infestation was having on the family. Chris found them to be incredibly resilient. One aspect of their predicament ran consistent with the classic pattern. Demonic spirits are often attracted to houses where young girls are going through puberty. The spirits draw on the particular type of energy the girls emit, the emotional level being very high and ideal for a spirit to feed on. What didn't run to form was the fact that the Smurls were a happy, religious family. To be honest, many, if not most, of the families we investigate are anything but happy or religious. What we usually find is drug or alcohol abuse, adultery, even occasionally child abuse, each an ideal entry point for demonic spirits. But here we had the most diabolical of demons. Believe me, when a demon rips a light fixture from the ceiling and nearly kills a young girl with it, we are dealing with the most serious form of infestation. And this was happening to a family who had not invited the spirits in through occult means or through sinful lives. And we now had exhaustive evidence to prove this. Chris and the team had spent long nights, entire weekends, and endless hours interviewing, evaluating, photographing, and recording family members in curious phenomena. Certainly one of Chris's strangest revelations to us on that spring afternoon when we were doing our final assessment was the story Jack had related to him. Simon, the family dog, had dematerialized right in front of Janet's eyes, and then, howling, had come back into earthly existence. You can't gauge the horrible impact this must have had on a sensitive woman like Janet. But even though the dematerialization was dramatic, it was probably no more impactful on the Smurl's mental state than the constant wall-banging, door-slamming, and whispering the spirits inflicted on the family. Our research teams keep their records in 5-minute increments, so it is possible for us to chart out the exact level of the infestation over long periods of time. Based on the team's notes and on Chris's articulate evaluation of the situation, we decided to move for a full exorcism of the Smurl home. Because of 2 particularly terrible events, we just wish we'd moved sooner. Raped by a succubus. Jack, would you describe what happened on the night of June 21st? The surprising thing was that the house had been pretty peaceful for 2 or 3 days. We watched a movie on TV, got the girls to bed, had some lemonade, and then went upstairs to go to bed. How did you first know something was wrong?
The way I came awake, I guess.
There was something different about it?
Yes, it was like I'd been, thrown off a cliff or something. You know, as if some violent action woke me up.
Can you describe what you saw?
At first I didn't see anything at all. I just felt this tremendous sort of panic. I wasn't sure if I was having a nightmare or not.
What convinced you that you weren't having a nightmare?
Her scales.
Her scales? You mean by those serpentine, snake-like scales?
Yes.
You said she. These scales were on a woman?
Yes.
Would you describe her?
To be honest, I even hate to think about her. Her skin was paper white, but it was covered in some places with the scaly surface I mentioned, and then in other places with open sores. The kind you'd think a leper would have or something. And these sores were running with pus.
How old was she?
I would estimate around 65 or 70. I can't be sure.
What else did you first notice about her?
She had long, white, scraggly hair, and her eyes were all red, and the inside of her mouth and her gums were green. Some of her teeth were missing, but those she had were very long and vampire-like.
What about her body?
That was the weird thing. Her body itself was firm, you know, like that of a younger woman.
What did she do?
She paralyzed me in some way. I saw her walking out of the shadows to our bed, and I sensed what she was going to do, but I couldn't stop her.
Then what?
Then she mounted me in the dominant position, and she started riding me. That's the only way I can describe it.
Was it pleasurable?
No, no. In fact, I don't remember feeling anything at all, other than panic and complete terror.
What was Janet doing during all this?
Only after I'd been awake for a time did I realize that Janet had earlier gone downstairs to sleep on the couch, which she occasionally does in the hot months.
What about the succubus? What was it doing?
Coming to a sexual climax, she just looked at me and smiled, showing those incredible teeth. I tried to look away, but something held my eyes to her. I could tell when she was having orgasms because she would give little jerks and her smile would broaden.
She was having orgasms?
Oh, yes, you could tell that by her expressions and her movements.
Then what happened?
Then she vanished.
Just like that?
Just like that. Just vanished. and that's when I noticed the sticky substance all over me.
Sticky substance?
Yes. I suppose you'd have to compare it to semen, the texture of it anyway. It was emitted from the creature's vagina, and I was sore, too.
Sore?
Yes. As if I'd had prolonged sex, even though it had been only a few minutes. But then I began to wonder if I hadn't passed out during it or something, because, as I said, my genitals were extremely sore. Did you have any idea what had happened? I called Ed Warren in the morning, and he told me all about succubi, that they don't have any gender, but that a devil that rapes a man is known as a succubus, and one that rapes a woman is known as an incubus. What happened next? I went into the bathroom and looked myself over. The fluid on my body had a very pungent odor. I took a shower and washed it off as quickly as I could. Had to scrub very hard. Then I went downstairs to tell Janet what had happened.
What was her reaction?
She started crying and said that no matter what, she was going to see that the church got involved in our problem and help resolve it. She said that the very first thing she was going to do in the morning was call the diocese office. Then something even odder happened.
What was that?
The next morning at breakfast, my daughter Dawn talked about a dream she'd had, about me being attacked by this horrible, ugly woman. She saw this hag with teeth missing and sores all over her body having sex with me. The thing was, I hadn't told the kids about the attack. Dawn couldn't possibly have known about my rape except through her nightmare. Both Janet and I were really startled and upset by this. It just seemed to make Janet calling the diocese office all the more important.
So she called?
Yes, next day.
Did they cooperate?
No. It turned out to be almost as terrifying as the succubus itself.
Promising phone call. The Roman Catholic Church is a bureaucracy in every sense of the word. Power is delegated in varying levels from the Vatican to literally every corner of the world. Following the attack of the succubus, which proved to both the Smurls and the Warrens that the demon was increasing the severity of its attack, Janet Smurl resolved to get the church directly involved in the haunting, no matter what it took.
Janet, I suppose I was a little angry when I called that morning. Here I'd been a faithful Catholic all my life, but my church wasn't helping at all.
She smiles. I'm slow to anger, but once I get worked up, I can be pretty formidable.
Janet was prepared to make her case argumentatively if need be.
Jack at work, the children at school, she sat down next to the phone, looked up the number of the diocese office, and called. The receptionist put Janet on hold, and a few minutes later, a man who identified himself as Father Calloway picked up the phone.
Good morning, the priest said. He sounded robust and intelligent and friendly.
Hello, Father. My name is Janet Smurl. I'm a parishioner in West Pittston.
That's a nice town.
Yes, it is, Father.
She drew herself up and said,
Father, I need to talk to you about some problems we've been having here.
Family problems?
Not exactly, Father. It's about a haunting.
There was a brief silence on the other end.
A haunting. I see.
I'm not a hysterical woman, Father.
I'm sure you're not, Janet. Why don't you tell me about it?
Then you believe in hauntings, Father?
Of course I do.
Janet could scarcely believe what she was hearing. She'd been prepared for battle. This priest was not only not arguing or evading, he was agreeing with her.
It's been terrible,
Janet said, letting some of her feelings come through clearly in her voice.
Why don't you tell me about it, dear?
So Janet told him. Everything. From the first rappings in the wall to the rocking chair that creaked by itself, as if somebody invisible were sitting in it, to the rape last night.
This is very serious,
Father Calloway said.
Very serious.
And the problem is, we can't get anybody in the church to help us. Not in any serious way, anyway.
What if I go to the Chancellor?
Do you mean it?
Yes, Father Calloway said. I do mean it.
and I'll be happy to make your case for you. I think that once all the facts are laid out, the Chancellor will get very interested in this case.
It's almost too much to hope for, Janet said,
feeling hope for the first time in many long and dark months.
Why don't you let me do some of the talking to the Chancellor, and then you can give me a call tomorrow morning. How would that be?
That would be great, Father.
Tears filled Janet's eyes.
I can't thank you enough, Father.
Gently, the priest said, just call me tomorrow, dear.
When Jack got home that evening, Janet rushed to tell him the news about Father Calloway and how helpful he was. Soon Jack himself was on the phone, calling a friend who knew several people in the diocese office. The friend had been skeptical about church officials helping them out. When Jack told the man about Father Calloway, the friend said,
I've never heard of a Father Calloway there.
Well, Janet talked to him, Jack said defensively.
You sure his name was Calloway?
Positive.
Tell you what, Jack, why don't you let me do a little checking and get back to you?
Jack laughed sourly. We're finally getting a little cooperation and you want to spoil it.
I just want to be sure everything is on the up and up.
All right, Jack said. Get back to me then. 20 minutes later, the phone rang. It was Jack's friend.
I called a priest who's a buddy of mine and who knows everybody in the diocese office.
And?
And there's no Father Calloway, he sighed.
I'm sorry, Jack. But Janet talked to him.
I'm sorry, Jack. But listen, I do have a name for you at the diocese office. Father Emmett Doyle. He's chancellor of the Scranton office. He's a very decent guy, Jack. He really is.
So it was that the next day Janet Smurl again called the diocese office. This time she asked for Father Emmett Doyle. He listened politely as Janet told him, first about speaking with a Father Calloway yesterday, and then about the haunting they'd been experiencing.
Father Calloway, you say?
Yes, Father.
I wish I could say there was a Father Calloway here, but I'm afraid there isn't.
So Jack's friend had been right after all. A possibility that Janet had been trying to deny since last night.
Do you know much about hauntings, Father?
As other priests had when she'd mentioned the supernatural, the cleric's voice became tight and guarded.
I am familiar with the phenomenon, yes.
Just then Janet realized that the demon could well be working overtime. Could it possibly have spoken to Janet on the telephone in the voice of a Father Calloway, thereby not only making a fool out of her and instilling her with false hope, but also damaging her credibility with this priest, the Chancellor?
It really happened, Father. I really did talk to a Father Calloway.
She realized how plaintive her voice sounded and was embarrassed for herself.
Why don't I take this matter under consideration, Mrs. Smurl, and get back to you tomorrow? How would that be?
That would be fine. I'd really appreciate it.
That evening, the spirits were quiet. The Smurls had a relaxed dinner of pork chops, fried potatoes, and salad. They were in good moods because of the prospect of the church finally intervening. Janet's talk with the Chancellor himself had considerably helped the entire family's state of mind. Next day, Janet spent all day by the telephone. She was so afraid of missing the call that she did not do her vacuuming, fearful the sound would drown out the phone. When she went to the bathroom, she left the door open. Even doing dishes, she ran the water slowly so that the sound wouldn't turn into a roar. Each time the phone rang, she dove for it, only to be disappointed by the identity of the caller. It was never the diocese. As soon as Jack came through the door, he said, "Hi, honey." He kissed her on the cheek, and then he noticed the sadness in her eyes.
What's wrong? He didn't call.
What?
He didn't call.
But he promised. Janet just shook her head.
Some promise.
In bed that night, Janet, still depressed, said,
"The church is never going to help us, are they?"
I wish I could say yes, but I'm afraid the answer is no.
Unfortunately, Jack's word was to prove true. The official church would never be of any real help, even though they did eventually dispatch a priest to satisfy the outcry of the Smurls' Catholic friends. Chris makes a discovery. At 6 feet, 260 pounds, Chris McKenna is a man with an easy laugh that is quite often aimed at himself and his liking for rich foods. As a professional demonologist, Chris quickly became a close friend of the Smurls because he was both good company and a great help in explaining all the terrible sounds and sights that had been filling the family home. The week that Janet talked to Father Calloway, Chris spent many hours at the Smurl house, and his diary notes the following phenomena. Heavy rappings at John's and Mary's house, and the sound of animal hooves, almost a clippity-clop sound running across the walls and ceiling of the duplex. Holding a crucifix up to the strange rapping sounds in the wall, and thereby driving the demon out. Scratchings from Mary's side of the hutch that sounded like rats in the walls. A drop in temperature that nearly froze Janet and Chris as they tried to clear one of the bedrooms of demons. An incredible stench that came as Chris started chanting to fill a room with Christ's love, a stench that drove everybody down the stairs. Janet being immobilized by some invisible force. "I can't move," she said to Chris when he asked her to cross the room. "It feels like rushing water is holding me back." Vapor issuing from Chris's mouth as if he were standing in sub-zero temperatures, even though the room in which Chris and Jack stood was measured at approximately 70 degrees. "The infestation has really gotten bad over here," Chris reported to the Warrens on the phone. "I don't know how much more they can take. There was even evidence of an incubus." He then related to them an incident in which the sleeping Janet had been sexually assaulted, but not raped. He also played for them a most disturbing tape. After recording the ominous sounds of the wall rappings, Chris had picked up something he hadn't counted on. As the tape unspooled, you could hear the sounds of pigs squealing. Lorraine and Ed, listening on extension phones on the other end, both realized that in the most serious infestations, the oinking of pigs is a familiar sound, pigs always being symbolic of a harsh, demonic presence.
"We have to do something," Chris said.
Grimly, Ed replied,
"Yes, we do, Chris. And fast."
The First Exorcism. Of all the Roman Catholic Church's rituals, none is more complex than an exorcism. The priest performing the ceremony must make certain beforehand that all family members are in the state of grace and are willing to truly give themselves over to the healing blood of Christ. In the experience of the Warrens, some exorcisms don't work because the families involved have not honestly declared themselves clean in spirit. And in other cases, the demonic forces are so strong that they simply cannot be overcome. The priest the Warrens called on to help with the ritual was Father Robert F. McKenna of Monroe, Connecticut. He was a traditionalist, which means that he broke with the church after the Second Vatican Council 25 years ago, when Rome insisted that the Mass be said in English, and that other fundamental changes in faith be altered too. Father McKenna found that many lay Catholics agreed with him. His parish was filled every Sunday morning with the faithful who chose to follow the old ways. The exorcism, as the Warrens warned the Smurls, proved to enrage the demon, who knew what was about to happen. The night before the ceremony, Jack found two strange, glowing women, one seemingly about 40, the other about 20, wearing bonnets and long dresses, standing at the foot of his bed. They were, of course, the same two women who had visited him months earlier. This time, however, they were accompanied by a man with light blonde hair and the creases of middle age on his face. When Jack tried to sit up and shout them out of the bedroom, he found that the entities had paralyzed him. "Jack, I was totally immobilized as they stood there and talked among themselves. Then the man leaned forward and shook his finger at me. 'You'll pay for this,' he said. It was obvious he was very angry." The three visitors remained in the bedroom another 5 minutes, whispering, pointing even, and at one moment laughing at him. Then the man of the trio looked angry again, his face twisted into an expression of absolute rage. "As I said, you'll pay for this," he repeated, and then they were gone as suddenly as they'd appeared. After a few minutes, feeling and movement returned to Jack's limbs. He woke Janet and told her what had happened. They spent the rest of the night huddled in each other's arms. While the research team went separately to the Smurls, Ed and Lorraine drove their van toward the New York state line. But suddenly Ed, who was driving, was seized by cramps and a high degree of fever,
His vision became blurred, and he became so weak that he had to pull over on the macadam.
"What's wrong, honey?" Lorraine asked, obviously concerned.
"Some kind of bug. You know how the flu can come on."
Yes, Lorraine thought. Flu, or other things.
They sat on the roadside watching cars hurtle by in the brilliant daylight. Ed only seemed weaker.
Finally, Lorraine said, "Dear, I think we'd better turn back."
"I hate to do that," Ed said,
but his voice reflected his condition. He was barely audible. Lorraine got out of the van, walked around to the driver's side, and took the wheel. She knew that there was only one place for Ed at this point, bed. She found the exit ramp and headed back home. In the hours before the ceremony, the Smurls went around their house, opening the doors to cupboards, closets, and anywhere else that spirits might hide while the sacred rite was taking place. Throughout the morning, the Smurls had been speculating what the ceremony would be like. Movies and television like to exaggerate such things. For this reason, Janet and Jack were apprehensive about what would actually take place. When they visited with John and Mary on the other side of the duplex, they found that the older couple shared their anxiety. They comforted each other by recalling all the reassuring things the Warrens had said about Father McKenna. Jenna went back to her side of the house first, and when she reached the kitchen, she found the room filled with the scent of roses. Quickly, she called Jack and Dawn in from the front porch. They smelled the rich, sweet scent of the roses, too. Janet felt an optimism she hadn't known in more than a year. Even the prospect of the exorcism was filling the house with God's love and driving out the demon. At 2 o'clock that afternoon, the 59-year-old Father McKenna pulled up in front of the Smurl duplex and parked his car. He is a man with light brown hair, eyeglasses, and a gentle voice. His large, powerful hands reflect his inner strength. He had grown up working hard, and those years of sheer grit had helped him through the physically draining performance of more than 50 exorcisms, 20 of which had been successful. The priest introduced himself to all those gathered in the living room, Jack, Janet, Dawn, Kim, Shannon, Karen, John, and Mary Smurl, and Brad from the Warren team. The Smurls had turned a table into an altar. The priest had told them how, after combining the rites of exorcism with the saying of Mass in traditional Latin style, the demon would, it was hoped, flee.
"We need to pray harder than we ever have in our lifetimes," Father McKenna said as he opened the black leather doctor's bag in which he kept the altar candles, cruets for water and wine, a missal and missal stand, small handbells, and a gold chalice.
As the priest set up the various articles he needed to say Mass, the room took on the appearance of a small chapel with 9 parishioners gathered for a special ritual. Once again the priest said,
"I ask you to pray for the salvation of your souls and to drive the demons out. I'd also ask you not to offer me anything of monetary value because that could hamper the exorcism."
Then he went upstairs to Don's and Kim's bedroom and put on his vestments. When he came back downstairs, he wore a white wool habit of the Dominican order and the ankle-length tunic of the vestment. A purple silk stole was around his neck and shoulders, and around his waist was a large 15-decade rosary, with the beads hanging on the left side of his body off a belt. The exorcism was about to begin, one of the truly ancient rituals of the Roman Catholic Church. The purple stole the priest wears around his neck symbolizes penance and thus humility, the priest begging God through prayers to free the infested home or person. Similarly, part of the ritual consists of adjurations to the devil, demanding that Satan, in the name of Christ, the Blessed Virgin, and all the saints, leave the person or home immediately. In some cases, the ritual consists of the priest demanding that the spirit or spirits who have caused the infestation speak out and identify themselves. Bishop McKenna, for example, has talked with many demons in the course of performing his exorcisms. Finally, there are the instruments the priest uses: holy water, a crucifix, and a relic of a saint, which is applied to the body in the same fashion, touched to the head or breast, for example, in the course of the exorcism. Despite the portrayals seen in recent movies, there is no chanting or singing at exorcisms. The priest prays in a loud, strong voice, and, in the instance of Bishop McKenna, does so in Latin. Dominus vobiscum, the Lord be with you, The ritual begins.
Now, Father McKenna said, I'll go into every room on both sides of the duplex and recite the prayers of exorcism. Then I'll sprinkle the rooms with holy water.
He explained that he'd like Janet and Jack to accompany him on his rounds, and that he would also exorcise the basement, the attic, the long backyard, and the small front yard. The first stop was Janet and Jack's bedroom.
Ecce crucem domini, fugit partes adversa,
the priest said in Latin. In English this meant, Behold the cross of the Lord, flee adverse enemies. As they listened to the long address the priest made to God and Satan alike,
Seize the dragon, the ancient serpent, who is the devil and Satan, and cast him bound into the abyss that he may no more seduce the nations.
Jack and Janet feared that the demon might choose this time to set the room afire or something equally drastic, but there was no sign of the demon as they went room to room, and finally they were back downstairs where Jack, who had been an altar boy, assisted Father McKenna in saying a traditional Latin mass. Then their fears were confirmed. As Janet and Jack knelt at the makeshift altar, they heard, coming from upstairs, the sounds of a child throwing a tantrum, a very young child, one who did not belong in the Smurl household. Then from the kitchen they heard cupboard doors beginning to bang shut. In front of them, just beyond Father McKenna, knickknacks and plants began to vibrate. Father McKenna only said the mass prayers all the louder, as if to spite Satan. Janet and Jack squeezed hands together and prayed as they never had before. The child's rage upstairs grew louder. The priest raised the chalice, celebrating the Son of Man and the Son of God. And then finally, the aberrations ceased. The child's irate voice could be heard no longer. The house ceased its trembling, and the scent of roses could once more be smelled. For now, anyway, the power of prayer seemed to be more powerful than the power of darkness. After he had completed the Mass, Father McKenna asked the Smurls to fill up a bucket of water. He blessed the water and told them to sprinkle it if any supernatural disturbances broke out after he left. In preparation for the exorcism, Father McKenna had been on a partial fast for 3 days, eating just one full meal daily. Janet offered to make him dinner, but the priest had only a cup of hot chocolate and a piece of cake. The Smurls told the priest how much they appreciated what he'd done for them. In return, Father McKenna stressed the fact that they should not give the demon recognition.
That's the worst thing you can do, he told them. But it's hard not to talk about it, Jack said, for all of us. That's where you must help each other, the friendly priest explained. Be sure not to mention it, and I think things will be better for you.
Then Father McKenna gave their house a general blessing and said,
I should start back now.
Janet came up and took his arm.
We can't thank you enough, Father.
The scent of roses drifted in from the kitchen. The girls smiled and said goodbye to the priest. There was the feeling that they had passed some kind of test today, that the devil had pushed them to the breaking point, but they had not broken. As a family, they had remained holy and moral and intact.
Goodbye,
the priest said. They walked him to the car, Janet still making offers of various foods she could pack for him. The priest smiled and said no.
Denying yourself is good for both body and soul.
He started the car and waved to them and was gone. The Smurls went back inside. There was a definite feeling of elation throughout both sides of the duplex. Could the demon be banished? One way or the other, the coming days would give them a clear signal. Ed Warren.
Lorraine and I stayed in constant touch with the Smurls in the hours and days following the exorcism. I only gradually overcame the mysterious illness that forced us back from Father McKenna's service, and even 3 days later was having trouble holding food down and walking, a buzzing sound having filled my head. Unfortunately, the word from the Smurls was not good, attesting to just how powerful the demon we were dealing with really was. Into our Smurls file went the following items. Tapping and hissing noises were reported by Mary Smurl on her side of the duplex. The smell of raw sewage overwhelmed Mary Smurl as she was doing housework one day. Clothing began disappearing from Dawn's room, causing an argument between her and Kim. Finally, they realized that the demon was once again hiding things to cause trouble between family members. Dawn watched as earrings lifted themselves from her jewelry box and began flying past her eyes. The family became so intimidated by a feeling of the demon in the house that they began going out to the garage to talk about it, lest they granted recognition. In the midst of all this, the Smurls had to deal with yet another problem. One night, Janet called us and said in tears, "Little Karen has been so sick that she's lost 7 pounds in less than 36 hours. All Jack and I can think about is the man who appeared and said, 'You'll pay for this.' It's the demon getting back at us, isn't it?" I tried to remain as calm and calming as I could, but the news over the next few days was a sort that can devastate parents. Karen Smurl got so sick that she had to be hospitalized for a week. The doctors did everything they could, but at first nothing seemed to help lower her fever or stop her from losing weight. Finally, Janet called one night and said, "Thank God, Ed, her fever broke today." At last, the doctors took control of the little girl's life. But by now we knew sadly and for certain, as did Father McKenna, that the exorcism had failed. We had no idea if Karen's illness had been caused by the infestation, but even if it hadn't been, all the other signs pointed to a demon sure of itself and still very much a presence in the Smurl home. The Apprentice Demonologist, Donald Bennett.
2 days after I read about Ed and Lorraine Warren, I contacted them at their office and told them how interested I'd become in the field of the paranormal. Unlike the others I'd met, I found them to be very human and, well, normal, I guess you'd say. The thing I liked about them right away was that while they took what they did very seriously, they also laughed a lot. They had a real perspective on their work, and that put me at ease right away. I wanted to know everything about them and their work I could, so they suggested that I start out by attending one of their lectures. "Demonology interests a lot of people," Lorraine told me, "but very few stay with it. I think you'll see why once you've been at one of our lectures."
A week and a half later, Donald Bennett drove his parents' Dodge to a small upstate college where he found an auditorium packed with people of all ages, not just the students he'd expected. Because of the sub-zero temperature outside, the windows were covered with frost that the moonlight turned into silver as the lights went down, and the Warrens began the first part of their lecture, a slideshow. Donald Bennett.
"I'd never seen or heard anything like it. Here was physical evidence, slide by slide, that the paranormal worlds we hear about actually exist, delivered in a calm, rational manner. There were slides of ghosts and slides of psychic lights and slides of objects being levitated and materialized. Ed told of seeing a 400-pound refrigerator being raised from the floor by invisible forces, of a console television set being lifted and then hurled to the floor, and of becoming involved with the Lutzes, the family whose plight became known as the Amityville Horror. After the Warrens concluded the slideshow, they took questions from the audience. I'd never dreamed that so many people had had paranormal experiences, but here were all these people, some very well-educated and well-dressed, some poor and not especially well-spoken, sharing experiences in an almost support group kind of setting. The evening could not have been long enough for me. Unfortunately, because a blizzard was brewing outside, everything had to be cut short after 2 hours. Afterward, as the Warrens were getting bundled up for their trip home, I went up to them and said that I was interested in becoming a demonologist. Lorraine and Ed looked very happy about this, but Lorraine warned me again, "Not everybody stays with the program, Donald." "Why?" I asked. She looked at Ed and said, "Fear. Just that simple. There's a lot of stress involved, as you'll find." But I really wasn't paying attention. All I'd wanted to hear was that they were going to accept me as one of their students. "So I can come up to your office?" I asked. Ed put out his hand, laughed, and clapped me on the back. He said,
"Welcome aboard, Donald."
They scheduled a meeting for a week later, when others would gather at the Warren home, and once again Donald found himself counting minutes, hours, days, till the time finally rolled around. Demon in the Shower. Following the exorcism, the Smurls were naturally optimistic about their future.
The scent of roses lingered, the walls were quiet, for a few hours at least. During this time, the phone scarcely stopped ringing. By this time, there were many in West Pittston who were well aware of what was happening to the Smurls. They called as concerned friends to see how the family was doing following the religious rites. Those who called 6 days following the exorcism heard about Karen's illness. Those who called a few days later were even more shocked. 16-year-old Dawn was in the bathroom. She had taken her clothes off in preparation for a shower. She would recall later hearing a rapping in the wall, but assumed it was nothing more than the usual, the demon reminding the family of its constant presence. Dawn ran water, testing it so it would be just the right temperature, then climbed into the shower. She soaped herself and leaned her head back against the wall, letting the water splash over her face. She felt relaxed after a long day at school. Then she felt something seize her arms. In front of her now she sensed a presence, an invisible entity that brushed against her the way a man would. Its intent was clear. For the moment, however, it contented itself with squeezing her arms until her eyes ran with painful tears. She pushed away from the entity then and hurled herself out through the plastic shower curtain. Instantly she began screaming for her parents. She grabbed a towel that was on the rack and ran from the bathroom, still shouting to her parents for help. After they had calmed their daughter, Janet and Jack began asking their daughter questions. They had no doubt about what had happened. If the incubus had materialized, it would have raped their own 16-year-old daughter in their own home. Lorraine Warren. Ed kept in constant contact with the Smurls following Dawn's near rape. Several team members took turns making the trip to West Pittston. What they reported was not encouraging. The demon continued to roam back and forth between duplexes, inflicting on John Smurl a body temperature drop so severe that not even several blankets could stop him from shivering, his teeth literally clattering despite the best efforts of his wife Mary to warm him. Janet woke up one morning with gouge marks on her right arm. The marks were almost 2 inches long. One of her fingers was swollen and had a deep puncture mark in it, as if she had been bitten by something. Mary Smurl also found slash marks on her arms. One day before she went shopping, Janet put the family dog Simon in the yard, which is enclosed by a chain-link fence. Janet locked all the doors in the house. There was no way the dog could have gotten back inside, yet when she returned home she found Simon in the living room. An incubus began to take shape in the bathtub as Janet bathed one evening, a creature no more than 3 feet tall with a gelatinous coating covering its gnarled body. Before it could completely materialize, Janet jumped from the tub, wrapped a towel around herself, and ran down the hall to her bedroom. Mary Smurl told Janet that water faucets in the house had been turning off and on by themselves, and pots and pans were disappearing. She had also found a stench in her bedroom, so bad that she could not enter the room. Janet got the holy water Father McKenna had given her and said to the demon, "I command you to be gone." Almost immediately they could feel the demonic smell leaving this room and entering the next one. They went from room to room, praying and sprinkling holy water. Finally, the smell was gone. On her way back from the supermarket one day, Janet noticed the smell of rotten garbage filling the family car. She pulled over to the roadside, took out the holy water she kept with her constantly, and drove the smell away. Apparitions began to plague the Smurls again. One day, for example, Jack was watching television when he saw a young man about 25 years old, with long blonde hair and an unpleasant smile, watching him from across the room. When Jack started to get out of his chair, the young man vanished. Jack was once again levitated from his bed and then hurled brutally to the floor. A visiting relative was driving past the Smurl duplex when he saw an elderly woman with very long white hair standing in the window staring out at him. The woman began to levitate and float back and forth before the startled man's eyes. Mary Smurl once again saw the faceless black form, and this time she became so depressed that none of the Smurl family could comfort her. In poor health, she alternated between long periods of silence and withdrawal and intense jags of sobbing. Over the phone one night, Ed and I explained again to the Smurls that there were 4 demonic stages, and that these were infestation, oppression, possession, and death.
Under infestation, the demon and spirits enter a house. This is followed by oppression, when the family comes under attack and harassment. In the possession stage, a demon can move into and possess a human being's body. Death was the ultimate goal of this demon, of that we had no doubt. I don't think the Smurls did either, which was why we suggested they spend a long weekend at their favorite campground.
You know, Jack said, that sounds like a great idea. Just pack up the family and take off.
Exactly, I said. It will help you get your mind off things. If only we could have known what awaited them.
Dark Outing. Sometime around noon on a Friday, the Smurl family put their food, soda, coffee, cooler, and other camping utensils in their 8-passenger maroon and silver 1979 Chevrolet van. On the hood of the van, a friend had lettered the Smurlmobile in white letters and maroon trim. It was a hot day, and the Smurls were in a good mood as they made their way past Scranton and drove northeast toward the campground near Honesdale. After they arrived and began unpacking, Jack became uneasy. The Smurls had been to this campground many times and always enjoyed themselves, but Jack Smurl felt something was wrong now.
I don't understand it, but I have a feeling of evil, Jack said to Janet.
Janet was surprised to hear this because of the good fun they always had in the outdoors.
What do you mean by something evil, Jack? How would you define it? She asked.
Jack got a bit edgy.
I can't describe it in words except that I just have bad feelings, he said.
Along with it being a hot day, it was also humid, and for a few minutes there was an air of tension between Jack and Janet. Neither one of them wanted to see the weekend ruined, and despite the problems in the house, getting away to the Poconos had always made them feel good. They decided to concentrate on having a good time. Along with swimming, there was a playground for the children, a recreation room, and the open spaces of the forest. They put on the pop-up, the plastic top that goes on the back of the camper. This provided welcome shade because there were only a few trees on the site. The day passed normally, and when Saturday dawned, another hot day was on the way. In the afternoon, Janet and the children were out, and Jack was sitting in the shade of the van with Simon. Jack and Simon were facing the clothesline where Janet had tied 5 bathing suits on the line and draped 6 towels over the rope. There was no wind blowing, but suddenly all of the suits and towels fell off the line at the same time. Startled, Simon jumped up and looked toward the line. Jack was also taken by surprise because he knew that Janet had tied the bathing suits securely. He was curious as to how everything had fallen off the line simultaneously, but he didn't dwell on it. That night, Janet and the kids all went to the recreation hall to play bingo. At the time, Don was 16, Kim was 14, the twins were 9, and their cousin Davy was 14. The youngsters got along well, and they enjoyed doing things with Janet. When it became dark, Jack decided to build a fire. About 9:15 p.m., the wood crackled and the blaze got stronger. Simon was sitting by Jack when the dog again became startled, as he had that afternoon, except this time Simon growled and looked over toward some bushes. Jack turned his head toward the bushes, and to his astonishment, there was a teenage girl standing there, about 14 years old, with long blonde hair almost to her waist, and dressed in a long colonial-style dress. The girl was standing about 30 feet from Jack near the road and by the bushes. Jack saw her clearly. She was looking at him and smiling. Simon continued to growl, and Jack didn't understand this because Simon has a friendly disposition and likes youngsters. Almost transfixed, Jack stared at the girl, and she continued to smile back without moving. After about 10 seconds, the girl vanished into thin air. A few seconds later, she reappeared, then quickly disappeared again. Jack thought that someone might be playing a trick on him. He went into the van and brought out a large flashlight with a 4-inch circumference beam. Jack looked over to the bushes, and the girl was back again. She just stood there, motionless, smiling at Jack. With Simon growling, Jack and the dog moved toward the girl. She disappeared. Jack and Simon went to the spot where the girl had been standing, but she was not to be found. Using the flashlight, Jack looked down the road and around the bushes, but found nothing. Later on, Janet and the children returned to the van.
Shannon and Karen went to bed, and sometime around midnight, Jack and Janet, Dawn, Kim, and Davy were sitting around the fire, drinking soda and snacking, when they heard a young girl's voice coming from across the lake. The near shore of the lake was about 50 or 60 yards from where the Smurls were situated, and across the lake was another 150 yards. In the quiet of the night, they heard the voice call out, "Help me! Help me!" Jack stayed with Kim and the twins. Davy, a strapping teenager who was a wrestler and football player, went with Janet and Dawn to the other side of the lake to determine if someone was in trouble. They took the flashlight with them, walked around the lake, and called out, but they didn't hear the voice again. Since no one had returned to their call, they thought it might have been a prank. On their way back to the van, they were walking past the small grocery store by the recreation hall when they were stopped dead in their tracks by what was taking place. Although there was no breeze, a heavy 50-gallon metal trash can started to spin around furiously just a few feet from them. The floodlight from the store was on, and they could clearly see that the can was spinning very quickly. Jack, who was waiting for them to return, looked out and also saw the can spinning. Janet, Dawn, and Davy looked at each other as the can continued to spin on its own for 20 or 30 seconds. The spinning then stopped abruptly, and the can fell over. There was no animal inside, and still no wind. After hearing the girl's voice and now this, Janet, Dawn, and Davy were unnerved.
"Let's get out of here,"
Dawn screamed, and the three of them rushed over to where Jack was waiting by the van. They grouped around the fire, all of them, frightened. Jack decided to tell them what had happened with the clothesline and about the girl he had seen. The Smurls searched their minds for logical explanations but couldn't come up with any. They left the campground the next day to drive home to West Pittston. Jack and Janet wondered if they were imagining all this. The apparition of the young girl and the violently spinning garbage can proved one thing to Janet and Jack Smurl, that the Warrens were right. Ed and Lorraine had told them that the demon could travel with them. The demon reinforced this on their way home. Halfway there, a terrible and unexplainable vibration began moving through the van, almost like huge sound waves that could crumble solid edifices in their wake. Jack had to pull over to the roadside before the vibrations stopped. The Apprentice Demonologist. A steep road led to a formidable house tucked into a deep cavern of shadows. The yellow light spilling from the windows seemed particularly inviting. Donald Bennett, still as excited as he had been a week earlier, pulled into the driveway behind several other cars and then went inside. 2 hours later, he found himself one of 7 people still spellbound by a presentation of charts, photographs, artifacts, and tape recordings, each of which revealed a special aspect of the spirit world. Seated around him were a policeman, a dentist, a service station manager, a college student, a nun, and a certified public accountant. First Ed and then Lorraine had talked, and then a man who revealed his first experience as an apprentice demonologist. Donald attributed the man's nervousness to simple anxiety over having to stand up in front of a group. But he soon realized that what the man was nervous about was his experience in accompanying Ed and Lorraine. The man, tall, thin, wearing a blue turtleneck sweater and a tweed sport coat with sleeves not quite long enough to cover his wrists, stabbed the button of a tape recorder and said,
"I went into a room by myself with a tape recorder, and this is what I brought back."
At first, all Donald could hear was ambient sound in the room, the machine itself running. But then a rapping started, slowly and faintly at first, then increasingly sharp and more frequent. Then the rapping was joined by an eerie panting sound, as if a huge animal had run out of breath. Then the rapping became gigantic thuds. Donald watched the man's face pale as the tape rolled on. He also noticed that the man's left eye had developed a tic. When the man was finished, Ed began giving an impromptu lecture about some of his experiences in demonology, seeing a crucifix literally explode when a demonic spirit focused on it, examining a human skull used for drinking blood during satanic ceremonies, studying a rag doll used by a demonic spirit that began to exert control over a very young girl, watching bottles of bleach and detergent being levitated behind him as he ascended basement steps, validating the authenticity of a psychic photograph taken in Mendon, Massachusetts that clearly shows the presence of a ghost.
Ed related many other incidents, then recommended that serious students of demonology study such books as Padre Pio, The Stigmatist, by Reverend Charles M. Carty, True and False Possession, by Jean Lhermitte, and Poltergeist Over England, by Harry Price. At the end of the night's meeting, Donald saw the man who had spoken go up to Ed, say something softly, and then put out his hand. Ed shook it. Neither was smiling. The man then went over to the hall closet, got his coat, and left. Donald sensed what had gone on, but left it for Ed to confirm. Addressing the remaining six students, Ed said, "Dean has decided to drop out. I don't think I have to tell you that his encounter at the house we took him to shook him very deeply. He said that he's slept very little since that night, and that he's lost his appetite, and that his wife is against him going on in demonology. I think right now he needs our prayers. So why don't we take a few minutes right now and say a short rosary for him?" Donald, though not a Catholic, willingly joined in the prayers. He had had his first glimpse of a man whose existence had been threatened.